This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of April, and this week, officials in Washington have been debating whether to raise the corporate tax and even whether to impose a new vehicle miles traveled fee to pay for new roads. President Biden announced new sanctions against Russia, aimed at retaliating for the SolarWinds hack of U.S. government agencies and companies, and preventing future attacks from Russia. And we've been following police shootings around the country as the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis draws to a close. But I want to start this week by talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for COVID. There have been 6 known cases of a rare and serious type of blood clotting in women who've received the vaccine in the United States. That's out of over 7 million doses distributed. And it's not yet known whether the events are linked to the vaccine. But federal officials have urged a pause in administering J&J while they investigate the clotting events. In part because J&J had a production hiccup that has delayed delivery of their doses, this pause doesn't have a large immediate effect on the U.S. vaccine rollout. Pfizer and Moderna are ahead of schedule in their production, and across most of the country, vaccines are becoming fairly easily available to any adult who wants one. But J&J is supposed to be a keystone of global vaccination efforts, and it's also supposed to help reach Americans who might otherwise be hard to vaccinate, because it's easy to store and transport, it doesn't require a deep freezer like the Pfizer vaccine, and it's only one dose. The government is very likely to announce within a couple of weeks that the J&J shots can resume, maybe with some new protocols, maybe with a recommendation not to give it to women under 50, or maybe exactly as it was being used before, after further review of the data. But public health experts are divided on the wisdom of this pause and whether it could unnecessarily alarm the public about an adverse outcome that is far less common than adverse outcomes from COVID infection. To talk about that, I want to bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Lanhee Chen, David and Diane Steffi Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Director of Domestic Policy Studies at Stanford on the right. Hello, Lanhee.
Hello. Thank you, Josh.
And on the left, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Hello, Jamel.
Hey, Josh. Thank you for having me.
Lanhee, was this vaccine pause wise?
I think it was wise to let people know that this was happening. It's not clear to me that actually going to a full-scale pause and stopping distribution of the vaccine was necessarily warranted here, because the challenge we were already having kind of coming into this entire process was a significant amount of vaccine hesitancy, particularly amongst people in certain parts of the country, people, frankly, who have held certain political views. So I do think that it's important for the public to feel like they're getting all the information. Of course, you would never want something like this to be hidden from the public. The question is, what was the right policy outcome? What was the right outcome for the FDA and for federal agencies to engage in, given that we are trying to get as much of this vaccine out as possible? And I don't know, quite frankly, that this situation where you had such a well-publicized pause to only be followed, Josh, as you note, probably by the resumption of the J&J vaccine being distributed, being administered. That, to me, it seems was a little hasty and probably doesn't help in the longer run goal of getting as many Americans vaccinated as possible.
Jamel, it's interesting. Donald Trump issued a statement that was probably as helpful as he could possibly have been with fighting vaccine hesitancy that could have been fueled by the J&J pause, basically saying that the pause was a bad idea. This, like the other vaccines developed under his administration, is a good vaccine that the Biden administration should let you have, and they should not be standing in the way of it. So at least he's out there messaging that conservatives ought to get these vaccines. But I guess, you know, what I see as the hard question here is that when you have this very rare outcome and you draw a lot of attention to it, that could further alarm people. The flip side is if you see government officials never adjusting their guidance based on new information about these frankly very new drugs that we have. I wonder about the extent to which that could further vaccine hesitancy, because the government, you know, it seems like the message is the same whatever the new information is. This signals, you know, we're taking these things seriously. And it also signals, you know, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, about which there isn't this concern, you know, those are still available. And we've seen in Europe, where there have been much bigger troubles with AstraZeneca, the public perception of the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna, has not suffered, even as there have been terrible troubles about trying to get people to get the AstraZeneca vaccine.
I've had a similar thought that imagining sort of the spectrum of vaccine hesitant people, some number of them are hesitant simply because they're just skeptical that anything developed so quickly could have no issues, and the government saying that these have no issues makes them suspicious. So in this weird way, the government saying, well, this vaccine may have an issue may kind of help these people have more trust in the process, which might lead them to get a vaccine. I find the whole question of how to tackle vaccine hesitancy both very interesting and just very difficult, because there are so many reasons. So much of this is socially determined. So much of this is informed by many different kinds of experiences. And it's hard for me to, you know, say with any sense of certainty or any sense of, you know, any sense of confidence that you know, pausing the Johnson & Johnson distribution, for example, was bad, or that it was good, or that there's any particular strategy that needs to be taken other than kind of encouraging people from across, or elites from across American society, to be open about getting a vaccine. But it's a difficult problem, and it's one of the many that I don't think is well served by kind of social media debates, because it's there are fair points to make on all sides of this.
We've been talking about Joe Biden's jobs proposal for several weeks now, in part because it has so many parts. There's always something new to talk about. And this week, a lot of the focus has been on the corporate income tax, which Biden would like to raise from 21% to 28%. Now, it was 35% before the tax cut that Donald Trump signed in 2017. Biden also has certain proposals aimed at reducing international tax competition, making it harder to shift profits abroad from the U.S. for tax purposes. And as members of Congress have discussed this, Mitt Romney has said he'd be open under certain circumstances to raising the rate to 25%. That's the rate he proposed when he was running for president, although he's not eager for a tax increase as part of this very large and, in his view, bloated infrastructure bill. But Shelley Moore Capito, who's a Republican senator from West Virginia, said for her and other Republicans, a corporate tax increase is a red line for them. Lanhee, is there evidence that the 2017 tax bill, which cut the corporate rate down to 21%, that that's fostered business investment or faster economic growth?
Well, I think it's a little bit early to draw that conclusion, quite frankly, given that we're only, you know, a couple of years into implementation of it. Certainly, that was the belief that drove a lot of people who supported it, and that's always been the belief for a long time. My view has always been, frankly, the certainty element of this is more important. In other words, what business probably doesn't want is a constantly changing tax rate, which makes it very difficult for businesses to comply and to figure out exactly what it is they need to do. I mean, frankly, look, there was a ton, even with the very high, relatively higher corporate rates, at least if you compare it with the rest of our of countries that would compete with America around the world, the relatively high corporate rate before this tax reform, what you found was a huge amount of gaming. Essentially, you had companies making the decision to domicile elsewhere to avoid the U.S. corporate tax, figuring out ways to avoid paying the U.S. corporate tax. So one of the theories behind lowering the rate to make it incredibly competitive was to avoid this precise kind of gaming, so that you would actually have people and companies, in fact, paying that rate and paying the taxes they were supposed to pay. The challenge, of course, now is if you decide, okay, we're going to hike the rate again, then in a few years, if there's a Republican president, is that rate going to come down again? You know, and then how do you have this back and forth over rates? So what I would much prefer is if we're going to do this, and they're going to decide, look, let's increase the rate back to 25%, we figure out some way to ensure that that rate stays there for at least some time, so that companies and those who are forced to comply have the ability to have that predictability around the rate. Because I think that actually is the bigger challenge for job creators and for those looking to create businesses than it is having, you know, a relatively higher or relatively lower rate, 21 versus 25. To me, that seems relatively less material than the fact that the rate keeps changing.
Jamel, I'm a little bit confused about who's negotiating with whom here, because I don't think we're going to see a bipartisan agreement on a corporate tax increase. And unlike the relief bill, where Joe Biden proposed it and then it got enacted into law and really very close to the initially proposed form, I don't think we're likely to see that with this jobs package. I think some parts of it will get done through reconciliation. Some parts of it could be done through appropriations bills or other regular bipartisan vehicles. Some parts of it will not get done at all. And so it seems like if you're going to change the corporate tax, that's exactly the sort of thing that you would do in a budget reconciliation bill. That's not like some weird trick. That's like a perfectly normal thing to do through budget reconciliation. So it seems like if you're going to have a corporate tax increase, I assume it will be a Democratic designed and Democratic enacted corporate tax increase. But is there enough uniformity among Democrats on tax provisions to do something like that? Because in addition to this, you're seeing a lot of Democrats from blue states saying, you know, as part of any of these packages, we need to restore the deduction for state and local taxes paid, which is a very large tax cut focused mostly on higher earners. So it seems like you could have a number of aspects of a tax agenda there in a year when, frankly, it doesn't seem necessary to me that there be significant changes to the tax code.
Right. To an extent, the White House has sort of gotten itself into this corner by way of President Biden's assertion and pledge that this has to be paid for, and by way of key Senate Democrats like Joe Manchin of West Virginia's belief that this any infrastructure package needs to be paid for. And when you combine that with the pledge not to raise taxes on most Americans, there are only so many places you can look, and a corporate tax increase is one of those. As far as negotiations are concerned, my sort of analysis more than anything else is that if there's a corporate tax increase passed, it is going to be through reconciliation, and it might actually involve a much larger reconciliation bill, maybe not the full $2.2 trillion that Biden proposed, but something considerably larger, just because I think the fundamental problem for attempts to do bipartisan deals is that there's a little faith among Democrats that any sort of Republican point person in the Senate will be able to bring over enough Republicans to break a filibuster on pretty much anything. And so in terms of there are these very public talks between a handful of Republicans and Manchin and Sinema, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. But I kind of think that's for show more than anything else, more an attempt to let that part of the process play out until they just get down to the reconciliation bill. I'm not so certain that there's going to be anything from this package passed outside of the reconciliation process, just for that reason, that I don't think Democrats have any faith that they could get 10 Republican votes for anything.
Lahia, I've been surprised during this process that the extent to which Republicans, at least in the Senate, and to some extent in the House, have been talking about ideas for alternative revenue raisers, if you're going to pay for new highways and that sort of thing. In particular, a fair amount of support for a vehicle miles traveled tax. The idea being we currently pay for roads with a gasoline tax, but if you have more and more electric vehicles and more fuel-efficient cars, in order to cover the cost of building and maintaining those roads, that maybe you should charge people for every mile they drive. And the theory in that makes a lot of sense to me. It also sounds like it would be a hideously unpopular idea. And we've not had a really broad-based tax increase on people with moderate incomes since the early 1990s, when we last raised the federal gasoline tax. And so how serious do you think those talks are? Is this just a way for Republicans to talk about why you shouldn't raise the corporate tax, say, oh, this would be the better thing to do? Or is there the germ here of what could be a bipartisan agreement on some sort of change to our broad-based infrastructure financing?
You know, look, it's never a bad idea to talk about more and different policy solutions. I'm not so sure, though, that at the end of the day, this is more than just spitballing. I mean, I think this is really about trying to figure out and trying to express the more important point, which is if you're going to do this infrastructure package, you have to be responsible about how you're spending money on it and where that money is going to come from.
It's kind of funny to have Republicans lining up to block an increase in the corporate income tax at a time that you're hearing at least more rhetoric from Republican officials complaining about corporations, complaining about what they call woke capital. They're upset about corporations making public statements on the liberal or progressive side of social issues, complaining about, particularly they're upset about corporations objecting to the Republican voting law that was enacted in Georgia. Jamel, I'm wondering, do you see content to that objection, because you wrote a column about this. A lot of the things that Republicans have been doing about their irritation with corporations looks basically just like trolling to me. You had Marco Rubio endorsing the unsuccessful effort to unionize an Amazon warehouse in Alabama, not because of a broad conviction about labor power, but basically to get back at Jeff Bezos for being annoying. You're seeing certain, you know, very amorphous ideas about how social media companies are mean to conservatives that don't really map very well onto policy changes that could actually do anything about that. Is there any content that you can discern to the Republican affective disfavor of the corporate sector?
You know, I don't think there's very much content to this. The closest thing to content is Josh Hawley has proposed, you know, some antitrust moves with regards to Major League Baseball. But even then, that seems very, you know, focused and specific on a single organization. There doesn't seem to be any appetite for really trying to, you know, apply more stringently, enforce antitrust law and apply antitrust thinking to broader sectors of the American economy. You know, to my mind, and this is what I argued in the column, if what you are concerned about is quote-unquote woke capital, which as a parenthetical, on sort of a slice of social issues, corporations have like progressive rhetoric. But generally speaking, you know, American big business, American corporations, you know, pursue their interests, which tends to be towards, you know, weakening labor power in the economy, enhancing their ability to act with as much autonomy as they would prefer. And so I personally am sort of skeptical that something like woke capital even exists. But to the extent that it does, what you would want to do, right, is strengthen the power of labor to kind of resist whatever encroachments those corporations want to make. And that just doesn't really seem to be on the agenda item, an agenda item for any sort of major figure in the Republican Party, which is, I wouldn't say shocking or striking, but it's noteworthy simply because this also is happening as some Republican politicians are trying to rebrand the party as sort of the party of the working class, of the American working man. And that one would think that this would maybe lead to a greater willingness to experiment with ways to increase the power of labor in the economy. But that really has not happened at all.
Lonnie, if labor power is not what Republicans see as the antidote to what they call woke capital, is there some other theory of, you know, what this problem is and what, you know, what sort of policy solution there possibly could be to it?
Yeah, I don't know that there is a direct kind of public policy response. I think it is more about the response in the court of public opinion, quite frankly. I mean, if you look, for example, I mean, just the entire debate and discussion around the reaction to the Georgia election law, I think is a good example of, I think, what conservatives see as the challenge when companies, you know, there's no public policy that's making companies respond the way that they do. There is concern about how people view those companies. There is concern about how those companies are portrayed in the mainstream media. That is, at least amongst conservatives, they believe that is what is driving what these companies are doing. So it's not so much a public policy response as just the concept of, you know, look, there are these companies and what are they reactive to and what are they sort of looking at as the things that motivate their activity. But fundamentally, when you talk about public policy here, I don't think the policy angle is the right one to view this discussion through. I think this is a cultural debate, much like many other things in our time and our day have become.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution and Jamel Bowie of the New York Times to talk about new sanctions against Russia. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Jamelle Bouie, columnist at the New York Times. This week, President Biden announced new sanctions against Russia related to a couple of ongoing disputes that the United States has with Russia. One of those is the SolarWinds hack and other cyber efforts by Russia to disrupt the U.S. government and U.S. businesses. Another is interference efforts that Russia conducted in U.S. politics on an ongoing basis, including in the 2020 election. But are these sanctions going to do anything? To talk about that, we're joined by an expert. Joining us for this conversation is Andrea Kendall-Taylor. Andrea is a senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for New American Security. And from 2015 to 2018, Andrea was a senior intelligence officer leading the U.S. intelligence community's strategic analysis on Russia. Welcome, Andrea.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about these new sanctions? They include restrictions on directly buying Russian government bonds from the Russian government. They exclude various Russian persons and firms from transactions with U.S. entities. One of those is Konstantin Kalimnik, who was a one-time associate of Paul Manafort. We also expelled certain Russian personnel from diplomatic facilities in the United States. One thing I've seen you say is these sanctions aren't just punitive. They're actually designed to directly interfere with Russia's cyber operations, such as those that led to the SolarWinds hack. Can you explain how that works? Why do these sanctions actually directly make it harder for Russia, for example, to hack us again?
Well, I think as you're right. So one of the key priorities, I think, of the administration was to try to disrupt some of these Russian actions. And so the six Russian companies that were targeted by sanctions include cyber companies that have been found to support SVR, the Russian intelligence services, execution of the SolarWinds cyber attack. And so by targeting these companies, it makes it more difficult for them to do their business and then in turn provide their services to the SVR. Likewise, we had the sanctions on 32 entities and individuals that attempted to interfere in the election. Those were some evolved in the Derkach influence operations, the disinformation efforts more broadly. And again, by going after those companies, A, we're shining light and exposing what they're doing, making public the intelligence that we have on those entities and those individuals and their role in these influence operations. But again, just trying to disrupt and make it more difficult for them to do what they do.
And then what about the punitive aspect? My understanding is the idea with this restriction on buying Russian government bonds is basically it's supposed to make it harder and more costly for their government to finance itself. But you can still go out and buy Russian bonds from a third party that was able to buy the bonds from Russia. So does this actually meaningfully impose economic pain on Russia? Why not also restrict secondary market purchases if we're really serious about this being a painful economic sanction rather than just something symbolic?
You're right, this is not the nuclear option. And I think that's a calibrated response. It helps this administration establish credibility that it is willing to go there. It is willing to go after sovereign debt. But then really importantly, it now leaves room for the administration to be able to scale up. There is headroom. They have clearly stated that we are willing to do more in order to impose even greater costs. And so that in that sense too, there's a deterrent effect in the sense that we've made clear we're willing to go there, and they're, you know, they can take that more nuclear option should Russia choose not to change its actions or, for example, escalate tensions on the border of Ukraine.
Lanhee, what do you make of this? Is this an appropriately tough set of actions toward Russia?
I do think it's an appropriately tough set of actions. I do think that it is something that sends a very important and a very tough signal. Quite frankly, that this kind of action, and by the way, this is not like a one-time thing. This is something that's been happening and going on for many, many years. And the politics of this is one of those things that I think, broadly speaking, is also going to be very popular. If you look at U.S. public opinion toward Russia, U.S. public opinion toward China, those are two countries and two governments that are not exactly in the public favor right now. So the notion of getting tougher on Russia in particular, I think, is something that will have a lot of public purchase and, quite frankly, is something that is an important signal to send against an actor that really has been hostile to American interests, not just for 2 years or 3 years, but for a much longer period of time before that, going back, to the early 2010s.
Jamel, you don't have to go back that far to a time when Republicans were more enthusiastic than Democrats for, you know, so-called tough on Russia measures. And I feel like for the last several years, foreign policy toward Russia has been viewed so much through the lens of Donald Trump and feelings about Donald Trump that, you know, it's kind of funny to now get back to a point where, I mean, some of this is about 2020 election interference, but most of this is sort of a post-Trump Russia policy. And so I guess the question is, does this, you know, does this broadly satisfy Democratic Party constituencies?
I mean, my sense is that they probably do, given precisely because of how much the conversation around Russia has been tied to Donald Trump, that I think for the kinds of Democratic constituencies, Democratic voters who are paying attention to this, having the president take a, you know, both a rhetorically strong stance against the government in Russia, as well as taking action of this kind, will sit well with those voters, to the extent that it's something that is really pressing and on their minds. I get the sense that sort of outside of kind of elite circles, no one's really thinking that much about policy towards Russia, which in some ways gives Biden quite a bit of freedom to do what he thinks is necessary.
Andrea, we had these news reports last year that got a lot of attention about a U.S. intelligence assessment that Russia had been providing so-called bounties to Taliban forces for killing American troops in Afghanistan. And one thing that we see in this announcement is these sanctions don't relate to that, because the intelligence community only assesses low or moderate confidence in that claim that there were those Russian bounties. And so was that story oversold last year? Is this a thing that really happened or not?
Well, I think, yeah, it's notable to see that the intelligence community came out with moderate to low confidence in the assessment. But one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, from my experience working in the intelligence community, oftentimes collection in that part of the world is very difficult, and getting to a high confidence assessment on something like that can be really hard. And so I think what you see in the response package is not the sanctions, but we do see as part of the package expulsions of Russian intelligence officers from the United States. And I think that's one way that the United States has chosen to respond, even with that low to moderate confidence. But I think, you know, the other thing it's important to note is kind of the transparency with which the Biden administration has come out with, you know, in talking about this. They put this as one of the top items on the list of unfinished business that they wanted to address as they were coming into office. You remember, you know, in the first day that Biden was in office, he sent a tasking to the intelligence community for their assessment on SolarWinds, on Navalny-related, the attempted assassination, on interference in the U.S. elections, and on this alleged bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. And so this is a government who is doing their due diligence and then being very transparent about what we know.
This announcement about low to moderate confidence with regard to the bounties in Afghanistan also comes at a time when President Biden has announced that we will withdraw from Afghanistan by September 11 of this year, which would be 20 years to the day after the terror attack that first kicked off that very long war that we've had in Afghanistan. And so, Andrea, the concern that's always raised about this is that if we leave, the Taliban will overwhelm the Afghan government and come back to power. Is it the right choice at this point to leave anyway?
So I definitely am not someone who follows Afghanistan closely, but I will say from the Russia perspective, I mean, this is one of the areas that the Biden administration has put at the top of its priority list for where they want to be able to work with the Kremlin. It is very much part of this balanced approach to Russia. We do see them taking this very strong, firm response to previous Russian actions. But at the same time, President Biden has proposed a summit with President Putin. And one of the things that I would assume would be on that agenda is working with Russia. As someone who has a stake and a role as one of the regional powers in helping the United States find a sustainable settlement there. So again, I mean, I think it shows this very balanced approach and this government, the Biden administration's ability to both take a firm stance to confront the Russians, but also be very sincere in wanting to work with them in areas like Afghanistan.
Lonnie, what do you make of that? I mean, you know, what I find striking is that, you know, we've been there for 20 years. We haven't been able to stand up the Afghan government with money and training in such a way that we can leave without them falling to the Taliban. Do you see Biden, you know, is this an approach that's going to work? Is this, you know, is this an area where we really can have productive engagement in Russia, with Russia? And that's part of how it's possible to finally end this war in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a morass, and obviously there are people who study this a lot closer than I do, but it does seem to me that this has always been the big challenge with Afghanistan, which is that it's very, very difficult to navigate, you know, all of the different entities and all the different parts of, you know, of the picture there. And so trying to figure out if there's some way to engage in a more broad fashion in the region, I think probably makes sense. I mean, obviously, the politics of this troop withdrawal, I mean, this is something that, you know, goes back to the fissure that there's been on the Republican side of things, at least with respect to, you know, how quickly and in what manner do we signal that we're withdrawing. I mean, these discussions and debates go back many, many years over many political cycles. And it seems to me that you're going to see this issue continue to be a one that's tinged more politically, which is this question of, you know, is this the right approach now? What are the downsides strategically as well as with this specific decision? Those are all conversations that I expect will happen. But, you know, obviously there is a huge political constituency, not just within the Republican Party, but I would say generally for what President Biden has announced here and what he plans to do. And I do think that that's something that, you know, he's taking advantage of.
Yeah, Jamel, it seems to me that former President Trump has given President Biden a lot of space here, which is that, you know, in a prior administration, he would have had a lot of Republican criticism about being it being soft on terrorism and soft on the Taliban to announce a date certain withdrawal. In fact, we did have arguments very much like that during the Obama administration. But now you see some Republican complaint about this. But really, this is becoming an area, as Lonnie notes, with a lot more bipartisan support for ending this war.
I think that's an observation you can extend broadly to Biden's presidency so far, that there are areas, the Afghanistan withdrawal, the COVID bill, this infrastructure bill, that I think the previous Democratic administration would have been much more hesitant about pursuing something of this size and scope. But President Trump, being at least rhetorically heterodox on these issues and willing to sign big relief packages and urging, you know, more generous benefits and urging a disengagement or at least a withdrawal from America's long wars, has opened up the space for Biden to do it, in part because Trump couldn't manage the follow through either for reasons of his own ability or the fact that he wasn't able to bring a sufficient number of Republicans along with him. But it's a very interesting dynamic in which these essentially the popular parts of Trumpism, such that they were, are something that Biden has been able to act on in ways that it'll be interesting to see how they play out politically, but I think this is an underrated dynamic. And I'll have to attribute this insight to my colleague Ross Douthat, who wrote a recent column on exactly this dynamic.
Andrea, one area in which the Biden administration is supposed to be providing a diplomatic break from the Trump administration is a return to more multilateral diplomacy, working with traditional U.S. allies with regard to adversaries such as Russia and China. It's remarkable that the financial sanctions here, we don't have a lot of allies joining us in those, even though there have been supportive statements about our position toward Russia from some of those allies. What is the state of that multilateral effort? And does Russia, do we have enough leverage on our own? Does Russia really care enough about the U.S. diplomatic position alone to be able to really force a lot of behavior change on them through what we do through these channels by ourselves?
Yeah, so I think with the Biden administration, you're right. I mean, has so clearly signaled from the beginning that allies and partners are kind of the centerpiece of our foreign policy. And that certainly extends to Russia, recognizing that we're far more effective when we work with allies and partners than when we go it alone. It is notable that there wasn't perhaps more coordination on the sanctions that were announced, although you're right to highlight that there have been a number of allies, the Australians and even others, who have come out with similar statements of attribution, for example, on SolarWinds and Russia's broader malign cyber activity. I think this it is in part because the muscle memory isn't there. You know, we had 4 years of the Trump administration where allies and partners were not part of our approach to Russia. And so, you know, we're early days in the Biden administration and we're reestablishing contacts and remembering how we work together as allies and partners. It is certainly, I think, a goal of this administration to do it that way. And one of the best examples, I think, is, you know, with the Russian poisoning of Skripal in the UK, you'll remember that there was a very coordinated response in expulsions from the United States and many European allies and partners. And that is something that gets the Kremlin's attention. So I think it's a goal. Working with allies and partners is something that this administration is working towards. But you will also see this administration be willing to move out when we can't get that consensus, because the reality is Russia is still a divisive issue in some ways in Europe. We have seen there is more common ground in Europe on the Russia issue, especially in the wake of the attempted assassination of Navalny. That created a little bit more convergence. But it is hard to get all of our European allies and partners on board. And so this administration is also saying, we want to be able to work with you. But when we can't generate that consensus, we are going to be willing to move ahead and take those steps and actions that we think are necessary and needed to respond to Russia.
Andrea Kendall-Taylor is a senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution and Jamelle Bouie of the New York Times. We will be back to talk about a couple of recent incidents that have Americans talking about police use of deadly force in the United States. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts. Or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Jamelle Bouie, columnist at the New York Times. Two shootings by police have been at the center of national news attention this week. In Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, Officer Kim Potter shot and killed Daunte Wright during a traffic stop. She said she had intended to fire her taser and mistakenly used her gun instead. Officers had pulled Wright over for an expired registration and discovered he had an outstanding warrant for his arrest. Potter shot him as he tried to get back into his car when officers were attempting to handcuff him. Former Officer Potter, who has resigned from the Brooklyn Center Police after the shooting, has been charged with second-degree manslaughter. And last month in Chicago, police officer Eric Stillman shot and killed a 13-year-old boy, Adam Toledo. A Chicago prosecutor had told a court that Toledo was holding a handgun at the time he was shot, but body camera footage released by the police department makes clear he had his hands over his head at the time he was shot. The video shows him releasing an object the police say was a gun before he put his hands up and before the officer shot him. These incidents have come to national attention during the prosecution of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin over the killing of George Floyd last year, and they all implicate the use of deadly force by police officers against non-white Americans. Jamelle, there's legislation that Democrats have in Congress right now, but what does a policy response even look like to ensuring that there is police accountability for the use of force like this?
That's a great question. I don't think that a policy response is necessarily going to come from the federal government, just because so much of these issues deal with local and state policies. We don't have a singular national police authority. We have thousands of individual departments and municipalities and cities and localities. So I think that's where a response has to begin and deal with. This issue is difficult because there are so many different issues involved in it. So you have use of force policies in individual departments. You have how police are trained. You have the culture of policing, one in which there seems to be very little tolerance for accepting any kind of risk to one's person as a police officer. You have the fact that the United States is saturated with firearms, and so this encourages, you know, a real sense of threat amongst police officers because they know that any given interaction could result in the confrontation with someone with a lethal weapon. You have a general absence of, I think, accountability, civilian accountability among police officers, police departments, in which in many places, many cities, police essentially dictate the terms of their own departments, dictate the ways in which they are, addressed, handled by outside organizations. And so, police in cities like Baltimore, for example, have threatened slowdowns when faced with accountability. The police unions have worked very effectively to shield officers from any kind of sanction or punishment for actions on the job. You have this, what I would call a democratic accountability problem, in which police departments act as if they really have no obligation to elected officials, to the public at large. And I'm going to be honest, I don't know how you deal with all of this. It's why I can find myself sympathetic to activists who want to just radically reduce the amount of money we spend on policing.
Lonnie, I find in general conservatives tend to be very attuned to the idea that public employees have excessive influence over the terms of their own employment and the manner in which the departments they work for operate, that they sit on both sides of the table. And in the context of police, conservatives will even say this about the financial terms of their employment, that their pension systems are overly generous and can be gamed and are designed to pay out more than the public really understood it was paying. And you see this conversation also about teachers during the COVID pandemic, that as we've had school districts being slow to reopen, that they are essentially putting excessive weight on the avoidance of any sort of risk to the public employees who work in schools compared to the significant social costs that come from the extended closure of those schools. I'm a little confounded about why that conversation doesn't extend more to police officers who are vested with this tremendous authority to kill people. And that, the same logic that says, the compensation terms are wrong, that there's an excessive focus on relatively rare risks to life of public employees in other places. Why that doesn't extend also to an alarm, frankly, about police departments and police operations being designed for the benefit of police officers rather than for the public who they're supposed to be serving. It's most analogous to the teaching stuff, which is to say that in both of these shooting incidents that we're seeing this week, I mean, in Chicago, the police and the prosecutors are basically saying that, this happened almost in an instant and he spun around with the gun and the officer was afraid. And you had an officer in the Minnesota case who was, that this was ultimately it was not a serious incident that got escalated to this point where you ended up where she, she says accidentally used deadly force in this way. But these are both circumstances where if we had a paradigm that did not, that said that officers had to accept some additional level of risk to themselves, that they had to be more judicious about the use of deadly force, even if that might make their job more risky, because that's necessary to serve the interests of the public. It seems to me like that's the sort of thing that policymakers and members of the public ought to be able to demand from police departments, but because of this extreme power that the police have as public employees, their safety ends up getting essentially this excessive weight compared to the safety of the public and especially to Black members of the public.
Well, this was one of the points of Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina. Tim Scott had a piece of legislation last year that looked at some of these issues, and one of the things he was saying was, look, we need to figure out, how can we disseminate best practices regarding excessive use of force, when use of force is appropriate. I mean, those are the kinds of things where we can have some guidelines that are broader than just what we're seeing at the state and local level. And I think that it is a useful exercise for us to engage in. I mean, the broader point you're making, Josh, is a fair one, which is that we cannot have a situation where all of the rules are being drafted by the people who essentially have to execute those rules. That there has to be another body, or there has to be someone else outside evaluating whether those rules make sense or not. And I think that completely makes sense. But yeah, I think this is why Tim Scott was focused on this question. And I think others have been, Democrats and Republicans both have been focused on how can we make sure that the best practices are the ones that are actually making it into states and into localities and into the places where these things actually happen.
Jamel, you mentioned the lack of democratic accountability here. I live in New York City, where we have a mayor's race ongoing. And an issue this week has been about illegal parking by public employees, including police who park over all over the sidewalks. And obviously, that's a really minor abuse compared to some of the excessive force that we see. But it seems to me it's emblematic of that, you have a sense that the rules do not apply to these public employees, to these police. And it's almost like a broken windows thing applied to the police, that basically, if they're not expected to comply with the small rules, why would they expect to be held accountable when they commit, really serious breaches of the manner in which they're supposed to conduct their employment? And so I guess the question is, how do you reassert that democratic accountability? Because, I mean, our mayor, Bill de Blasio, who ran on a police reform platform and has made certain policy changes, basically, it seems like sometimes he will announce something and the police department basically thumbs its nose at him, even though he is the elected official and they literally work for him. Is there a model that ensures that the will of the public actually gets implemented when, as you describe, the police do have this power to essentially threaten to slow down, not do their jobs, and the public does want policing and protection from crime, and that ends up being a powerful threat?
Right. This is where you get into this conversation about, quote unquote, defund the police. That for as much as there are criticisms of what that would mean for public safety, I think the strongest political argument for it is that there has to be some way basically to assert democratic control over these departments. And budgets are sort of how that typically happens. Maybe it's not simply, doing straightforward cuts to police services, but it's devolving some elements of policing to other departments to handle traffic enforcement, mental health calls, to basically reduce the number of officers there are, or at least refocus them, and maybe begin to break some of that power. It's tackling police unions, which I know amongst sort of labor organizers are not seen as really being part of, organized labor, but being something wholly different. But it is, I happen to think that this is the central issue, that if we are going to give a set of public employees the right to use lethal force, then those public employees have exceptional responsibilities to the public. It means, and if we're going to compensate them highly for it, right, it means they do have to take on more risk. It means they do have to be more responsive to elected officials. And the extent to which they aren't, I think, is not just dangerous to the public, but just sort of corrosive of the very idea of self-government, when you have basically an armed state force that does not believe it has to obey the public or serve the public, serve the public in a way that may go against its own interests. I think it's dangerous. However we address it, I think it needs to be addressed.
That strikes me as simultaneously too small and too large, which is to say, I don't think defund the police is a credible threat, because politically it lacks support. And when the rubber meets the road in these cities, I mean, Minneapolis, you could get the city council to pass a resolution saying they were going to dismantle and rebuild the police department, but then they didn't actually do it because of what the implications of that would have been. And at the same time, if you have police abusing their authority, and the threat is, I mean, Ferris Stockman had a piece about the Suffolk County, New York Police Department, and they took away enforcement on the Long Island Expressway from them. That's not really direct punishment for whatever it is that the police might be doing wrong. And B, they were ultimately able to defeat that politically and get that back and get all the overtime pay that was associated with that back to them. It seems like, I mean, and this is as we're watching the Derek Chauvin trial, it seems like addressing these issues of excessive force has to involve penalties for excessive force. It has to be easier to fire officers who break the rules, and it has to be in egregious cases easier to get them criminally charged and convicted. And we see these extremely high profile cases. We might see a guilty verdict in the Chauvin trial, but it seems to me like that democratic accountability has to be more direct. It has to be that if you abuse this power, you'll get in trouble for abusing that power. And I guess the question is, how is it possible to do that?
I mean, I think so. I think that would require – I mean, that doesn't just require a change in law necessarily, in policy, but it requires changes in who actually enforces the law, right? Prosecutors, DAs. It requires sort of changes in jurisprudence. Right now, kind of the legal standards are tilted heavily in favor of police officers. It more or less requires a wholesale attitude change within the criminal justice system with regards to police. And I'll just kind of – because I don't disagree with you at all here, Josh, and I would add that one – other element of this is sort of punishing police officers who sort of lie on the job. This is kind of a common observation that in terms of police officers, you know, reports about violence, reports about arrest, lying is very common. I mean, if you start to go down the line of the ways in which police departments and police officers behave in ways that kind of cut against their charge, there simply is no sense of any obligation to the public. And so enforcing the rules, enforcing the law and punishing officers who break the law has to be part of this. And I'd like to think that this is possible, right? That we can begin to change out how we address misconduct. Although I do understand and sympathize with those that say that the institution is just too far gone.
That's all we have time for today. We're going to forego our rants this week, but they will be back next week. I want to thank Jamel Bowie, Lanhee Chen, and Andrea Kendall Taylor. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay and is recorded and mixed by Michael Stark and Kat Yor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.